Half an hour in, and we're on to dirt snakes already.
Yes.
Hello, I'm Nipper Reed.
And I'm Phil Wolf.
So, settle down, have a nice cup of tea, and enjoy the Venomous Exchange Radio Podcast.
Crumpets, Nipper. I want the crumpets.
Well, as you've been such an extraordinarily good boy. Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us again. We have a fabulous guest today, which is streets ahead away from us because he's in Namibia. I have no clue what the time is in Namibia at the moment, but we'll find out shortly. Phil, I'm afraid to say, is not 100%. He's a bit Tom and Dick at the moment, but he's going to soldier on.
That's an expression I don't think I've heard before, Tom and Dick.
No?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I've heard like under the weather, you know what I mean?
But okay. Like,
Tom and Dick?
It just means you're sick.
I need to know the etymology of that.
We'll talk about it off air. Phil's got bronchitis at the minute, but like a massive hero, rather than lay in bed and sob like a millennial, he is still with us. So we're going to carry on. We are very, very pleased. I'm going to mess this up.
You're not. You got it.
We are very, very pleased to have Francois Thiart. Close that enough.
That's correct.
Yay. Well done, me. All the way from Namibia. So, Francis, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it. I've got to be honest, we're going to leave it to you. Tell us all about what you do in Namibia.
Goodness. So I have many, many titles in the country. I'm quite well known here, obviously, for my my work with snakes primarily. I am actually one of two herpetologists in the country at the moment. So we're a small group of people. And I'm also part of the National Snake Bite Interest Group. Which I'm one of the founding members of. And then I also serve on the government's Neglected Tropical Diseases Working Group, specifically focusing on snake bites and scorpion stings.
That's awesome.
And then I have a small organization called Snake Conservation Association of Namibia, which is a voluntary organization. So this is where we basically train people to go out and remove problematic snakes from people's houses across the country. Off the top of my head, I think we're about 20 snake removers now countrywide, maybe even more. Snakes have always been a passion. Now it's an obsession if you bring research into it. So pretty much what I do.
That's fabulous. Now, for the geographically challenged amongst us, and by geographically challenged, I mean Americans, can you just let them know where Namibia is?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, one of the main things that's quite funny to me always is if people talk about South Africa, they kind of include Namibia. Obviously, Namibia used to be part of South Africa up until the 1990s when we gained independence. But Namibia is located in the southwestern corner of Africa. So basically South Africa to the south, Angola to the north, and then Botswana to the east. So that's pretty much where we're located. It's also not completely desert. We have a variety of different habitats in the country, but we are considered to be one of the most arid countries in Africa, at least.
How much of the Namib Desert actually takes, how much of the country is the Namib Desert? Excuse me.
It gets a bit complicated because to the west you have the Namib along the coastline. So that stretches from southwestern Angola all the way down to the northern parts of South Africa, the northwestern part of South Africa, that is. And then you have the Kalahari Desert towards the east. And then you have this weird thing called the pro-Namib, which is basically not true desert, but pretty much just on the fringes of it. So, I won't say most of the country is desert. It's a very small portion of it. And then if you go up towards the northeast, that's where it becomes a bit wetter, and we almost have rainforests, or not rainforests, but forests. It's a really interesting place. You know, herping is worthwhile. It's definitely a place that people need to visit.
It's 1,000% on my list.
So I'm going to ask you the obvious question. What are the big dangerous snakes for you? Because our previous guest did a lot of work in snake bites and snake rescue in India. And there was a number of specific species that were problematic in that area. What's the problems for Namibia?
The biggest issue we have is obviously spitting cobras. And what makes it very complicated is we have Naja nigricinta nigricinta, the zebra spitting cobras, of course. And this particular snake is by far responsible for majority of the bites. Now, what's also a big issue now is that the antivenom, neither the SAVP product works or the current premium serums or the product from Costa Rica. So nothing really works for this snake unless you have early surgical intervention, which is our protocol in how we're dealing with a snake bite. And the other primary issue with this is this snake can cause a bleeding tendency. It causes acute kidney failure, and we recently had a case where someone actually had damage to the heart muscle from the venom, which is really strange if you look at the typical picture of spitting cobra bites. What's even stranger is in areas where you have like Mozambique spitting cobras and zebra spitting cobras, the zebras just still bite more people. We rarely actually see Mozambique spitting cobra bites in comparison to zebra bites.
That's incredible. And I was just going to ask you, you know, you hear horror stories of Eastern South Africa and Southern Mozambique of just Mozambique spitters just going into houses and just arbitrarily biting people. And I would have never imagined that the zebras are similar to that, but yep. I guess it is.
Yeah, and it's pretty much the same. So we have a fairly good data set on this. If you look at when the bites occur, it's between 10 at night and 6 in the morning, usually when people are sleeping. We've been quite fortunate that we don't see a lot of fatalities. Unfortunately, in young kids, it's a bit of a different story. And yeah. To complicate matters even more is that you tend to get some really bad primary infections in the snake bites as well. So we published a study in 2023 where we mocked these snakes and we actually picked up bacteria in the venom itself, which is injected along with the bite. And then you can even get necrotizing fasciitis, which is quite bad. And we had one case where unfortunately a child got that, and this child ended up dying. On top of having a severe envenomation, he also had a very, very severe infection on top of this. Necrotizing fasciitis, combine that with a really bad cytotoxic venom, and you're pretty much screwed.
Wow. That's such a shame. So how do you combat that? I know you mentioned earlier some pre-surgical stuff. How do you combat that? Because I imagine you can't necessarily give them normal antibiotics, but then at the same time give them antivenin. I feel like it would almost counteract itself, right?
Yeah. So the current treatment regime for this is, you know, is a bit radical in terms of your normal snake bites, I suppose, but what we currently are doing is we do early surgical intervention. So we debride as early as we possibly can, unless it's bites to the face or bites on the genitals, then we're just a bit patient with that. But usually within the first 6 hours of the bite, we start with surgical debridement. What was quite cool was we were also able to identify the antibiotics in order to treat the infections as well, you know. So we know that this particular bug is not resistant to what we're using because we were able to test it beforehand. So we have quite a rigorous regime in terms of antibiotics. I can't remember most of the names for it, unfortunately. But that's pretty much how we do it. And then obviously, you know, a lot of fluids, aggressive fluid management, In some cases, vitamin K as well as blood transfusions are required. And that seems to be making a fairly big difference in terms of the outcome of these bites. But the primary issue we're still sitting with in Namibia at this stage is, you know, that majority of the doctors can't really manage snake bites appropriately. So we're ending up with a lot of cases that come to the larger referral hospitals in the capital at least, you know, 2 or 3 days later, and then they're already a wreck. And then it's a run against the clock to try and save them.
Now, what is it about this particular species that the SAVP doesn't work and the Costa Rican stuff doesn't work? Is it just something that because it's not included in the initial mix when they're generating it in the host animal?
That is pretty much correct. It's not included. But we also have another hypothesis as to why, in general, we don't see good results from spitting cobra bites. Now, the primary reason why this tends to happen is because if you look at the anti-inflammatory response of the body and all of that excessive swelling that's around the bite site, you know, the anti-venom molecules are simply too large to reach it and can't neutralize it. You know, you can probably argue that for the systemic stuff, there might be a form of cross-reactivity. But then again, from the study that was published by one of our doctors recently, that's also not true. I would think the best way to approach spitting cobra bites in the future would more than likely be a monospecific antivenom. You know, that would have a higher rate of success, I think, personally. Because if you also look at antivenom production, the more stuff you add to it, that may potentially impact the efficacy of that product.
Is there an age range that people are getting bitten? Is it agricultural workers, or is it across the board?
It's across the board, really. And I mean, if you look at this snake, it is just highly adaptable. It's also, in terms of conflict, it's one of the snakes we remove most of the time. But what's really interesting is if you start to look at the demographic, it's not just agricultural workers. I mean, it's people that get nailed in major towns and cities in their houses and in their beds. We had some toilet snake incidences as well, which is not ideal. I've seen a couple of bites on scrotums, which is not nice, of course. I think I would just die personally.
That's a shit day out.
Yeah, just pick it up and start playing with the snake so it finishes the job.
No, which snake are you going to play with?
Yeah.
So you know, it's not just limited to certain demographics. It's just literally across the board. If you look at the age range, again, this is quite interesting because we see bites from children under a year old all the way up to 70-year-olds that get nailed by it. But I would say the most prominent bites we see would be in young kids, at least from my experience. I think in a season on average, we see about, at least the bites we're aware of and that we work with ourselves, is about 100 spitting cobra bites alone. And I mean, everyone has this story about, you know, Bittus arietans and all of this being the snake responsible for most of the bites, but that's not really what we're seeing. I can count the number of puffer bites I've seen on my hands the last 12 years. So it's honestly more spitting cobras.
Wow. Now, is this also in more rural areas, or is it suburban areas? Is this more, I don't want to say impoverished homes or more rundown buildings, or is this just anywhere?
Anywhere, both in impoverished areas. Obviously, that's where majority of the bites come from. But also in, if you look at your demographic, middle class, upper middle class areas are also affected by it. So it's a really strange thing that is happening. And if you compare this again to some of your other snake bites, let's look at black mambas, for example. Most of the bites there occur in impoverished areas where people don't have access to healthcare. And the same goes for Cape Cobra bites. But it's with a zebra spitting cobras, it's just a whole different ballgame. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. I need to understand why this is happening. What is the reason behind it? And, you know, we're still working on a couple of projects on this to try and determine this.
So you said that there was a secondary effect of bacteria within the bite. Are you hypothesizing that this is an evolutionary part of it, or is it just a coincidental element to it? So is it like going down the road of monitors, or is it it's just a case of bites being untreated and infection?
It's very difficult to say. I honestly don't know. My gut feeling is it might have some evolutionary value, or perhaps once these snakes hatch out and they start to eat, the bacteria actually colonizes the venom gland. Now, how we actually came upon this was there was a study done by the University of Northumbria, I believe, on Nigricolis and on some spiders, and that's where they actually started to pick up the bacteria in the venom glands itself. And when we had this bite with this kid, we couldn't figure out what the hell was going on, because it was just the most horrific necrosis you've ever seen in your life. And we got to that point, basically, that we had the snake alive, fortunately. So we were able to milk it, swab the venom, swab the mouth, and we picked up the venom, that bacteria in the venom. So my hypothesis would be that that perhaps the bacteria colonizes it, but it would be interesting to get into more work. And, you know, if there's anyone out there that's interested to make this part of a study, why not? We're always open to collaborations. It would be fantastic to get some guys on board.
Yeah, that'd be incredible. It's interesting because that particular species is so rare, at least in our hobby in the US, that they go for big money. And I don't know if there's more than a handful of them in the US as of right now. I'm sure there's more in England, and I know there's way more in Germany. But that would be very interesting to try and put something like that together.
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of trash snakes in Namibia, so probably every call out that my team gets would be zebra spitting cobras. But there's even something stranger with this thing. Now, if you go towards the south of the capital of Windhoek, so we start to head to southern Namibia and more towards the arid regions where they overlap with black spitting cobras, they actually integrate with each other. So then you get this pitch black snake with white bands on the belly. So it's a really strange looking thing, and it confuses the shit out of all of us whenever we get a picture, because we usually ask the people then to flip it over so we can accurately identify it. But there's like integration happening in the cobras as well, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, that's very. Now, I know there was three independent species of Nigricolis. Were three subspecies, excuse me. Are they now all three independent species?
Yeah. So basically, Nigricolis was, Nigricolis nigricinta, which it was sunk. So nigricinta was elevated to full species. And then Woody is now considered to be a subspecies of nigricinta. Whether that's going to remain like that in the long term, I don't know. Hopefully they don't sink it. Yeah. Damn the taxonomists. They're the absolute worst sometimes. But we'll see what happens. I'm actually busy collecting some DNA on them, and hopefully collaborate a bit more with Wolfgang Wooster. He's a good friend of mine, and we've been working on a couple of projects on Bittus as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you had mentioned, while we're still on the venom stuff, you'd mentioned about black mamba bites. I know most people don't associate black mambas with Southwest Africa. They think, you know, more jungle, more tropical, you know, savanna type, not necessarily arid. Give us some information about some southwestern black mambas.
Well, our mambas are quite interesting in terms of where you find them. I mean, we have records of specimens in the southern parts of the country, literally on the fringes of the Namib Desert, you know, where you start to see the dunes are performing a bit, which is really weird. Like, even if you go to the Naukluft National Park, which is in the southwestern, south central western corner, if that makes sense, of the country. And what's really strange is these mambas, if you look at them, are almost pitch black in color. They are not gray. They are pitch black. And even the ones in Windhoek look quite strange, which is the capital city of Namibia. And if you find them here, then usually the head is almost pitch black in color and the rest of the body is like gray. So it's a strange snake. I mean, there's even some records in the Kalahari of these things. But, you know, obviously with temperatures changing in the long term, are they still going to be there or are they just simply going to die? I know with the Kalahari at the moment, the temperatures are so high that a lot of animals are just, you know, dying out. So it's going to be interesting to see in the long term whether these snakes actually will be able to adapt to that.
Wow. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
So, having a quick look, it would appear that the majority of snakes in Namibia are venomous. You seem to have more than your fair share of venomous creatures in Namibia. You've got so many species of cobra there for a relatively small country.
Yeah, so and don't throw away Aspidolaps. You know, I think this is also quite an important one. I know in the United States, for example, and in Europe, it's always considered to be a good starter snake. But let me tell you something.
I won't touch that.
They freaking pack a punch.
Really?
They are bad, man. They are so bad.
Really? That was my first proper venomous snake I kept.
So. Well, did you have Lubricus or Kaulesi?
Lubricus, because they're pretty.
Okay, so if you look at Kaulesi, so let me tell you a bit of an interesting one that I published. I think last year I published this paper, but we had we know four confirmed fatalities from this snake.
Wow!
But what makes it absolutely terrifying is how quickly this happens. Now, the one bite we had was a 60-year-old woman. She was bitten in her sleep. Don't know what the hell it is with cobras and people in their sleep. And this woman literally died within 4 hours.
Wow.
Of that bite.
Wow.
Now.
And that's not anaphylaxis. That's the actual venom.
It was the actual venom. She was dead on arrival at the hospital.
Wow.
Then we had another case, which was a 5-year-old child that was bitten. The police actually phoned me for this one. The child died within a matter of 30 minutes.
Damn. Wow.
The child was unfortunately dead. There was another case recently, what I suspect to be a Aspidolaps bite. Same story, person bitten at night, 2.5-3 hours, he was dead. So the question is just how potent are these Aspidolaps really, and is it worth risking taking a bite? And you see the same with Scutatus. If you look at Aspidolaps scutatus, I was consulting on a case, 30-year-old guy that got bitten, young man, and he was within 30 minutes they had to put him on a ventilator. So
wow. Wow.
I've just looked up on my normal go-to clinical toxinology resources.
Don't look at that gauge. That little gauge. That color gauge is horrible. If you look up inland Taipan, it'll put it in the red. If you look up Ashes Cobra, it'll put it in the middle in green. Get the hell out of here. And for those listening, us talking about Aspidolaps, Kaulesi, and Scutatus, we're talking about the African coral cobra and the African shield nose cobras.
Yeah, but it is saying they're mildly venomous.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, at least not from what we've seen. I believe there was an old paper that Bill Branch published where where he actually mentioned that the toxicity is almost on par with Dendroaspis. But you know, there's just not enough info. Again, this is something I would like to continue with or give it over. Give it over to someone else that's willing to work on it.
Yeah, my memory of them is that they were so incredibly fast. You know, I mean, I know elapids are generally fast, but these seem to be like little grease lightning.
Yeah, I feel like everyone who does venomous in the States, they get it in their head. Oh, I can have an elapid. It's relatively small. It's relatively easy to take care of. And supposedly, it's relatively mild. But I've worked with Lubricus. I've worked with Scutatus. I've worked with Kalesi. They don't ride a hook.
No, they do not ride a hook.
Worth their shit. They're always fired up. They're reluctant to eat if you're staying there. They're reluctant to eat if you're not staying there. They're just not a good beginner venomous. But I digress. Sorry.
No, they're super cool snakes. I mean, I've worked with them in captivity as well quite a bit, and they're just absolute machines when it comes to eating, and they're relatively simple to keep. But I really, really think that, you know, one has to be super careful about saying that this is indeed a good starter venomous snake, because my personal opinion is there's no such thing as a good starter venomous snake. And you just literally need experience of how to work with it, with the stuff. But also talking about Aspidolaps lubricus, there was a guy bitten in the United States a few years ago, and this was again published. This particular gentleman was 40 years old, if I recall correctly, was bitten twice on his hand, and he was ventilated. And this wasn't Kaulesi, this was lubricus. So the entire thing of what people need to understand about these starter elapids, as they call them, is, man, make sure you know your shit before you even get into that.
Now, correct me if I'm mistaken, but there's currently no specific antivenin for any of the Aspidolaps, right?
Correct.
Wow. That's something that we all forget about.
Yeah.
So I think in this study where this gentleman was bitten, they did test the cross-reactivity with the SAVP product, and they did find that there is some cross-reactivity and it might be beneficial to give it. But as most of you probably know now, the SAVP is a complete and utter shit show, because they just closed down now, so there's no antivenom coming out of it. And this has put extensive amounts of pressure on the South Africans and the rest of Africa. So most of the countries now have shifted over to premium serums. Indian product, it's good, but it doesn't cover all of the species again. So back to square one, pretty much.
He said earlier on that you don't see many puff adder bites, which I find really strange. I'd have thought they'd have been a very significant part of the work you do.
Surprisingly not. I'm going to tell you something a bit even weirder now, is we see more Bittoscodalis bites than bloody puff adder bites.
Wow.
So Codalis tag more people than puff adders.
That's amazing.
We have puff adder bites, but definitely not on the scale that you would see, for example, in Kenya, where people get annihilated by them. Here,
is that
in a season, we get like 5 or 10 bites from puff adders, maybe.
Is that because it's a relatively uncommon animal in your area, or is it just that people aren't in the areas where they are?
Well, no, they're common. Along with the zebra snakes, I mean, this is a snake we always encounter, but from personal experience of going, if you go out herping and you look for them, they're damn tough to find. They're not easy. They're definitely not hiding under every single bush. So we honestly don't see a lot of bites. And again, most of the ones I've seen is just, again, when people tend to mess with them, pick them up, and all of that. Oh, goodness, what is going on? So yeah, that's the primary issue that we are sitting with at this stage, you know, is we just simply don't see it. But Codalis bites, on the other hand, every single year, there's at least 20 to 30 Codalis bites.
Wow, I would have never thought that.
No. So, in terms of fatalities, you're not looking at fatalities from Codalis, are you? Or are we?
So from Cordalis, no fatalities. They do pack a mean punch. I mean, it will definitely ruin your bloody week. But fortunately, they don't kill. And then obviously, the dirt snakes, the stilettos, they bite quite a lot of people. I had a case yesterday.
Half an hour in, yes. And we're on to dirt snakes already.
Yes, I had to do a double take in my headphones. I was like, did he just say dirt snakes?
He said dirt snakes. Half an hour in, and we brought dirt snakes out. Oh my days,
Phil. I know it's your absolute favorite, even though there's other cooler snakes.
Other cooler dirt snakes. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still have Elapsoida Sundavali, so I just like them.
They're pretty cool. So Elapsidia, where I'm at, you get Fitzamonzi, which is the Kalahari garter snake. You get
Gorgeous.
I believe Angulensis as well, the Angolan, yeah. And then you have the Zambezi garter further north. So they're pretty special snakes. We don't see bites from them, unsurprising.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's
well now. So what stiletto species do you guys have by you?
So we have Dirdeni. And we have Bibroni, which is the two main ones. The more common one is the Bibrons.
Yeah.
But again, really interesting. The severity of the bites are not as bad as the ones in South Africa.
Interesting.
Typically, we don't see loss of digits or in our cases. Most of the time, the people just get an abscess and they drain the abscess and the guy's good. So
wow,
really weird.
That's fascinating. Do you think it's a dietary or just a regional thing?
Well, I think it would be dietary, and especially if you look at the prolonged droughts that we sometimes have in the country. Sure. So I would assume that our stiletto snakes primarily feed more on lizards as opposed to rodents, like you'll probably get in South Africa.
Right.
So that's why I think the venom is also a tiny bit weaker.
Absolutely fascinating.
Now, the other thing, which I'm super jealous that you get all the dwarf, or you get a number of dwarf bitis.
Yeah, the pictures that he sent me before the show, I gotta forward them to you.
Yes.
Brother.
Well, it is the only reason I think I want to go herping there for the dwarf bitis. I just think they are amazing.
I'm just going to hold this to the screen real quick, just so that Nipper can see. Look at this.
Oh, my days. Yeah. Snake porn.
Have you ever seen a zero that patterned?
That is awesome.
I'm sorry. Francois, please continue.
Yeah, so look, I mean, the bitters are the main ones. So everyone that usually comes to Namibia wants to tick them all off. So a very good friend of mine, his name is Dane. Now this name might ring a bell because he was the first person to actually find and photograph Bitis heraldica.
Wow.
So
yeah,
lucky. So very he's actually cool. going up to Angola now to go and try and find it again.
Wow.
And between the two of us, we usually go on, well, he takes the herpes and I usually just tend to tag along because I like to be in the field. But we do a bitters rocket run usually. So
that sounds best.
Well, it's pretty extreme. I mean, the quickest I've actually found all dwarf bitter species was in a week.
And oh my days!
With Wolfgang Wooster and Dr. Nick Caswell from Liverpool. So man. It took us like literally a week to find all of the bits.
That's a dream adventure, man.
That really is.
That's an adventure of a lifetime. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys, look, I mean, if you want bitters, you just need to come to Namibia. There's certain spots that are exceptional for zero paga. I'm pretty certain every time I go to the spot, I find them. And then Bitters Piringui is probably the easiest one. I mean, really? That's literally... 5 minutes and you'll find it.
Oh my god!
Well, then Cordalis can be tricky. They can be quite tough. I was on a trip recently to try and find them and struck out, unfortunately. But Kornuta is fairly, that is probably the easiest one. So if you go to Luderitz, and I'm sure for those of you mainly in the hobby, you would know the ghost Kornuta from Luderitz, the very famous ones. But they're simple to find. My record for one morning was 7.
So, you found 7 of the ghost Kornuta in a morning.
That's awesome.
That's incredible.
I mean, the other interesting one is obviously Bitter Schneidery. That one gave me a bit of a tough time. It took me 4 attempts to find them because it's very different from South Africa. So in South Africa, you just pretty much go onto the beach and you look for them and you get them. In Namibia, you have to go into the damn dunes to find the thing, and finding a snake that's like 20 centimeters long is not very easy.
I've just Googled Bitter Schneideri in Namakwa.
Yeah,
Namakwa land.
Yeah, and the first photo that came up is by some bloke called Francois.
That's great.
That's funny.
So
great photo, by the way.
Thank you. I'm trying. I'm not the best photographer, but I'm trying.
Yeah. You're doing okay.
So, but guys, bitters are that's the money snake. If you want to come to Namibia, it's some of the best herping you'll ever have, and just the diversity of habitats that you'll be going through is insane. One thing I will say is that the driving will kill you. We're a small country, a large country by mass, but when it comes to population, we're about 3.5 million in Namibia. So it's not a massive population. So finding towns and things in between is quite difficult. You'll spend about 10 hours on the road most days to go and tick off what you want to find.
Worth it. Absolutely worth it.
Sounds like herp in Spain. That's fine. That's cool.
I actually, I have a bitis question I was going to bring up to you. A few years back, I want to say maybe 2017, this picture was floating around on some of the snake ID pages. And some people said, oh, it's from Ghana. It's photoshopped. Other people said, no, it's from Namibia. And what's really interesting is the fact that if you look at its face, you see the double triangles. It's clearly East African, but I got this desert. They call it the desert Gaboon. Have you seen this?
I've not seen that.
So
that looks like almost like the ones you find up either in Zambia or Angola, actually.
Okay. So this is supposedly Namibia, and it's definitely not, if it is photoshopped, it's not that photoshopped, but it's got the double triangles. It's clearly an East African.
Yeah, look, I mean, we don't really find Gaboons in Namibia. Gaboon's closest known record is about 150 km from the Namibian border in Angola. So unlikely that we get them here, but that animal, at least the ones I've seen from Angola, look fairly similar to that.
Okay, so it is just a normal East African Gaboon, but it's a locality phenotype.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting.
When you're out herping for your fabulous dwarf bitis, do you ever see the chameleons?
Yes, we do. They're pretty rad. I mean, that's my absolute favorite also to find out in the Namib. The best place to get them, in my opinion, would be Swakopmund, which is a small coastal town. And I mean,
as we speak, Germans are booking tickets.
Well, they can try. We're waiting for them. We're ready for them this time. but the chameleons are pretty easy to find. It was just a big problem during COVID where a lot of them were actually poached. So in that Swakop area, there's a lot of eco tours going into the dunes. And when a lot of these guides obviously lost their jobs, they were going in and just absolutely cleaning the area out. So the chameleon population in that area took a dip over the last couple of years. But right now they seem to be recovering. And when was it? About 2-3 weeks ago, I found one when I was down there.
Oh, so not beautiful. Not I'd love to keep. I mean, they are extortionately expensive captive bred. I mean, but they are fabulous looking things.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, they're super cool.
They're not. A lot of the guys, some of the reptile parks in Namibia that have kept them have had quite good successes as well. So they're not too difficult to keep, but I think you also need to fluctuate your temperatures a bit, just giving the area that they're coming from. Especially your nighttime temps, I reckon you have to drop them a bit, because if you look at the coastal populations at night, you'll be looking at about 15 to 10 degrees Celsius
Wow.
is how cold it can
Wow.
get. So what's also really strange is that these little chameleons, where they go and stay, is just like underneath a little bush or something. So there's obviously not a lot of cover for them. It's really, really interesting. If you look at how the hell the bloody chameleon survives there.
Yeah, and how their hands are still, they still have the same hands, even though they're not climbing branches. It's fascinating.
So sometimes you will find them in like little shrubs, in the desert, but I mean, these guys actually mission over dunes as well. So you'll just sometimes get chameleon tracks that go over a sand dune, which is pretty wild.
Yeah.
And they move very far, about a kilometer a day, if not more.
Wow. That's
Wow.
insane. Now, talking about herping in the dunes, is it similar to other deserts that I've been to where most of the time you're following tracks to when they stop and then you're digging in the sand, or are you road cruising, or how do you go out and find the dwarf adders?
So the dwarf bittus, particularly, I have certain times that I go out to look for them, but usually it is mostly to do with tracks, and obviously with specifically with Caudalis. They like bushes. So if I find an area where there's a bit of a hammock, so which is a small little dune in theory with a bit of vegetation, that's usually where I'll get my Caudalis. And with the Piringuis, it's just very simple, really. Again, looking just for areas where there's a bit of vegetation and soft sand, and you'll get them 9 times out of 10. Early mornings is really good because then you can find the tracks and you can find them out basking, and then just before sunset is the ideal time. So because I've been working on a Caudalis project the last couple of years, which we're just finishing up now, I mean, the time frame of peak activity for Caudalis is usually 7 in the morning until around about 9 o'clock. Then they're active, and then from just before sunset, I believe. So you can work from about 7 until 8 o'clock is when you find lots of them.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I think South Africa and Namibia are really, really up and coming in terms of herp holidays at the moment. They seem to have overtaken, the old favorites like Costa Rica and Borneo. I think people are now looking to do a little bit more further afield. And I think, Namibia, how would you recommend that people join organized tours to go and herp Namibia? Or would you say it's safe to do solo?
Yeah, and there's one person you want to make use of for that, and that's Dane. And the reason why I only particularly trust him is because, one, I know he's probably one of the best herpers in the country, if not the best one. And the second reason is he also usually has the permits and stuff to do this, because he's also a collaborator with the National Museum of Namibia, and he samples and everything. We recently had an incident where guys came to Namibia and they were going out and trying to obviously find dwarf bittus, and then the Namibian government got whiff of it, and they actually went to their hotel, made them unpack all of their bags to make sure they weren't poaching. So, which they were obviously very pissed about. But it's always best just to go with someone that knows, and that knows the rules and regulations. It's not a bad thing to come on your own, but a lot of the areas that he would necessarily have access to would either be national parks and places where you normally can't go in. So
Yeah.
that's why I think that's very important. Or you can link up with me.
That's very cool.
We can put a link for Dane in the bio if anybody's interested in joining one of his trips.
Yeah, definitely. I'll send it. I'll send through his details and everything. He's a great guy. He's actually, you know, the two of us are collaborating on this Codalis project we're working on right now. And the man has seen some crazy shit. The fact that he's going up to Angola now, he's actually taking a herping group to Angola, and they're going to go try for Bitters Heraldica. So we're going to see within the next couple of weeks if he's going to find it.
That's incredible. I mean, it's incredible enough that anyone can actually herp Angola now, which is great. Yeah. You know, considering it's been not the easiest place to access for the last few decades, but that would be an incredible trip.
Yeah, look, I mean, Angola has changed a lot. They've opened up quite a bit for tourism now. There's big growth in the industry over there, which is very exciting. And obviously with the herping stuff, you know, they have all of the guys there. The hotels is just horrendously expensive to go up. Obviously, if you have the crazy amounts of US dollars lying around, it's not too bad. But, you know, for the average person, me, for example, I can't afford to go up there on a herping trip at this stage.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
But it's on the list. So, I mean, have you got a project? Are we going to get a new Snakes of Namibia book out? Come on.
Well, I'm working on a bigger guide, but I did bring out a book a few years ago. It's titled My First Book of Namibian Snakes.
I was waiting to bring that up. Fantastic.
It was actually meant to be a kid's book. It's hilarious. But you know, Namibians don't like to read a lot. So it's mainly filled with pictures, and we've covered most of the common species in there. The book has been doing pretty well locally. I believe we've sold about 7,000 copies of the book now.
Excellent.
And it's not very expensive. So
I know it's on Amazon.
It's similar to the Rand. So I think locally we charge about 185 Namibian dollars for the book. I don't know what that is in US.
Here, I know it's on Amazon.com. So let me on our Amazon. Let me just pull it up right now, and we'll find out.
So, but
are we going to get a proper herp field guide to Namibia? Is what I'm asking.
That is in the process. Yes.
Good stuff.
But this one, the book I'm working on now, is going to be similar to Johan's Snakes of Southern Africa. Yes. This one is just going to be focused on Namibian snakes.
Excellent.
The problem is with the Namibian reptile one is the freaking amount of reptiles is ridiculous. I think we have 250 species of reptiles. So finding and photographing all of them is a
mission. Yeah. But certainly the snake one will be fabulous. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, the snake one, there's obviously some taxonomic changes coming. So I'm just waiting for those changes to happen. And then I'll include that in the book. But this one will be a bit more scientifically orientated and not going to be like a simple, easy guide, I suppose, which is very important to me. I would also assume that Phil is into scorpions, judging by...
Oh, why would you do that to me?
And what's... I can't find it right now on Amazon. I know it was there. But it looks like you're at... Yeah, 175 Namibian Rand. And looks like if you get it on... There's a German site. It's 17 euros on a German site. So...
It's nothing.
Everyone should have one. But Francois, please tell me about scorpions in your lovely desert land. I tell you, but before you jump in, so Paul, Cape Town Paul, has told me about his adventures crossing the border and some of the coolest scorpions ever in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, so I mean, Namibia has a very high scorpion diversity. I'm pretty shit with scorpions, to be honest, but I've been kind of forced to work with him over the course of the last couple of years because of the amount of stings we've been getting of the stuff. So I think off the top of my head, I can't remember majority of them. But you know, we obviously have Parabuthus granulatus, villosus, Schlechteri. What else is there? There's then obviously your Europlectes and your burrowing scorpions.
Yeah. Yeah, Epistothalmus, interestingly, some amazing Epistothalmus species.
Man, I'm going to tell you a bit of a secret. I actually discovered a new genus of scorpion.
Really?
Of course you did. Why wouldn't you?
But the worst thing that could potentially happened. So the National Museum in Namibia lost the damn specimen, so I had to go out and look for it, that I couldn't find it. And the way I found the scorpion was by actually chasing after a Swamophis. So went under a rock, flipped the rock, got the snake, and then I saw the scorpion, and then sent it to some guys, and they were like, oh shit, this is a new genus. I'm like, okay, can you find the specimen? So I go back to the museum, and they're like, oh no, sorry, we lost it. So it was like the worst thing ever.
Oh jeez. Now, was this an actual lost it, or was it like, oh no, we lost it?
That's what I don't know. So hopefully it pitches up somewhere. But it's
gotta go find more.
It's a difficult thing to find. That's the problem, because I tried for it in Feb. I went up and I tried to look for this shit thing, and I couldn't find it. It's gone now. And then
what kind of scorpion was it? Was it a burrowing species? Was it a Boothidae of some sort?
Not a Boothidae. I actually don't know. No one knows what it is.
Interesting. So, I mean, was it, fat claws? Was it fat bodied?
So if you look at the claws on this thing, the closest species I can think of is Lispisoma elegans, which is an endemic species to Namibia, but it has relatively small claws and a relatively small tail, almost Europlectes like, if you will.
Yeah.
But that's the best description I can give of this thing at this stage. And I have one shitty picture of it in a plastic bag.
Jeez. Well, that's exciting, man. It makes me want to go there more. Oh, it's awesome. I hope you find more of them, man. I really do. I hope you get to at least name the little booger.
We'll see if we can find more of the specimens. Now there's also
some... Nipparensis is a good name. Just putting that out there.
Nice.
We can try. Did you make any decent contributions to arachnology or herpetology in the last couple of years?
I let a spider out of my house without my missus killing it. I suppose that's the most I've done.
Well, we're gonna go to Namibia and we're gonna help you find it, and then we'll just do a collaboration of all the letters of our names. It'll just be this long, horrible name.
what I'll tell you guys about Namibia is if you ever come to this country, vegetables in Namibia is basically chicken and fish. We consume lots of meat, we consume lots of beer, and we consume shitloads of Jägermeister as well. So
excellent.
Prepare
sounds perfect.
Yeah, this is like my dream place. They've got snakes, they've got scorpions, it's a desert, like
it's low carb diet.
Yeah. Fabulous. I'm in. Yeah.
No, we don't do carbs, we just do meat. I have a bit of an interesting story when Wolfgang was here. So after we found that pretty Zeropaga, we drove back to Windhoek. And there's this little restaurant in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere. It's called Canyon Roadhouse. So we stop here. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. Wolfgang goes into the bathroom, and there's a little box. It's called Pandora's Box. And he opens this damn thing. It's 10 o'clock in the morning, and the next thing we know, we just get a freaking round of Jägermeister at 10 in the morning.
Awesome.
I nearly died. So excellent. Then Nick goes into the bathroom, And he thinks, oh, no, this is fantastic. This is probably just a joke. He opens a box and the freaking next round of Jägermeister comes through.
So oh, my days.
That was pretty wild. But they're a good group of people. If you ever have the opportunity to get Wolfgang Wooster on the show.
We would love Wolfgang on the show, although yeah. I feel I wouldn't be able to speak with fangirling.
Yeah, I don't know how we're going to do it. I mean, we did Mark O'Shea. We can do him. That's for sure. But he's definitely on the list.
You know, the Mark O'Shea episode was just absolutely fantastic. And I know he was in Namibia a few years ago, I believe, as well, doing some work on the zebra spitting cobras at that time. So, I mean, all of these guys, I've been quite fortunate, you know, in my very short career to be able to meet and work with some of the best herpetologists out there. Wolfgang is one of my favorite people. He's just exceptionally smart. He makes me feel really stupid, like 90% of the time.
Nice.
Yeah, and then Brian Fry. I've been quite fortunate to have met him when I was in the Netherlands. Again, fantastic guy, super knowledgeable. And just if it comes to toxicology, man is an absolute beast. If it comes to publications and knowledge on that topic.
Awesome. Very cool, man. Very cool. Side question. Have you ever seen the Edward Bolin in person?
Sorry, have I ever seen that?
Yeah, the Edward Bolin, the ship in the desert. Maybe I'm saying the name wrong. I know it's Edward Bolin. It was a German tanker that crashed on the coast, and over the years the desert's pushed back there's like a boat in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, I have. So I've
always wanted to see it in person, and I wanted to herp that boat, that shipwreck.
So that's along the Skeleton Coast.
Yes.
This place, the Skeleton Coast, is a pretty wild place, with exceptions to reptiles. You also get desert lions there. So
wow.
You get the lions that walk all the way to the coastline to hunt seals, which is pretty wild. You have brown hyenas there as well. And then obviously you have some pretty sick snakes out there too, like your caudalis and your peringuis. We actually herped that area in February, and not much turned up, unfortunately, but exceptionally good spot for caudalis if you're looking for them.
Very cool. Very, very cool.
Yeah, Namibia is very different to a lot of other places. If I can give you an example, the usual road I go cruising on, if I go look for cobras and mambas, some evenings we're quite lucky. We can find aardvark, brown hyena, and leopards as well. So, and that's literally a 20-minute drive out of the city.
Wow. Incredible.
That is incredible. So just to take you back, sorry, a question I wanted to ask earlier. What is the ethos of the local people in terms of snake bite? Will they, if bitten, think I'm going straight to hospital, or will they do a witch doctor or folklore or herbal remedy or something like that?
That's a really good question. Surprisingly, but this is again due to a lot of work we've been doing, is we actually don't see a lot of cases where people go to traditional healers for help. Most of the time they go to a clinic or to a hospital. Where the primary issue comes in is what treatment is that hospital or clinic giving. One issue we are sitting with at the moment still is the entire tourniquet thing, which is a pain. We had one fatality because of that, where a guy was bitten by a puffer, put on the tourniquet, and I think he waited like 5 days or something before he went to hospital.
Did he wear it for 5 days or just waited 5 days?
I think he wore it for 5 days because Jesus. I remember getting the phone call from the hospital. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were like, oh, we have this guy on the operating table. We just removed this thing that has been on for this amount of time, but we're sitting with a problem now because the gentleman, unfortunately, is not responding. So, wow. I mean, removing that thing more than likely caused that all of those toxins and, necrotic tissue just shot through the body and unfortunately killed him.
Wild.
thank you so much for pronouncing tourniquet correctly, because I just very few people do.
Hey, look, we have the British school system in Namibia, so kind of have to pronounce it the correct way.
Awesome.
I say herb just to piss him off. I'm gonna go cook in the kitchen with some herbs.
Yeah, the bane of every existence.
Yeah, bless you, Phil, for thinking that's the only thing you do that pisses me off.
Yeah, that, and we're good, right? No.
Yeah, there's so many.
Wow. Well, Nibber, is there anything else you want to touch base with him? Oh, what's up, Francois?
What I think would be something very interesting to run through, maybe, yeah, is my Mamba Bite.
Oh, yes, I had
in 2016.
Yeah.
So I reckon you guys will enjoy this one. Well, why was I bitten? Because I was a dumbass, number one.
Always the way.
So what happened was I got a phone call for a 2-meter black mamba at the international airport. And pretty much went out for the removal. The snake was in a tree. It was harassed by some people. They obviously tried to kill it. So I got a cherry picker, went up into the tree to try and get this thing out. Mamba decided to bail. So he was actually chilling on the grass. And then social media brigade, cell phones out, walked straight to the snake. And it darted. And it nearly went into the main terminal building full with hundreds of people. So I got down and I ran towards the snake and I grabbed it with my tongs. But because I was so, you know, stressed out with all of the bloody people around me, I misjudged the length of the animal and I grabbed it too far back. And literally this mamba just swung around and hit me straight on my hip.
No.
So,
wow.
I didn't even realize.
At the moment it bit you on the hip, I cannot imagine what went through your mind. Honestly,
the funny thing is I didn't even feel the bite. So when I had the snake restrained, I was walking back towards the bucket with animal in the tongs. And I just felt this weird burning sensation on the side of my body. And I was like, what the hell is this? And as I lifted my shirt, I saw two perfect puncture marks. And I was like, well, fuck.
my ass would literally drop out at that point.
So the first thing I did was obviously I just put the snake in the bucket and closed it up. Immediately phoned our snake bite doctor that I work with very closely. And his first reaction, well, we're good friends, was like, oh, you're joking. It's like, why the hell would I phone you 12 o'clock in the afternoon if I was joking about a mamba bite? So what was really strange was the time I had to wait for the symptoms to kick in, because initially I thought it was a dry bite.
Yeah.
So about 5-10 minutes later, the symptoms just absolutely battered me.
Really?
The first thing I felt was tingling tongue and lips, the paresthesia that comes with that. That was the very first symptom. And when I got that, I knew I was in trouble at that stage.
See, that is almost having knowledge of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Makes it a lot worse than if you're uneducated about what happens when you get bitten, because now you've got a countdown in your head,
yeah,
as to how bad it's going to be.
Well, the thing is also, you know, working with snake bites and dealing with a lot of communities, you know, it kind of put me in that space of how the people will actually panic when something like this happens. And I will lie if I tell you now I wasn't scared.
Oh, of course.
I was shitting myself.
100%. 100%.
So any snake handler out there that says, oh, no, I wasn't scared, dude, don't lie. That element of fear does creep in as much as you prepare for it. But what was really interesting after the initial paresthesia, then it was just like a domino effect with all of the other symptoms starting to come in. So what I experienced, the next one I got was excessive muscle spasms that were so freaking bad that it pushed me to the point of vomiting, which I suspect was also part of the symptoms. But the pain in my lower back was just so intense I couldn't sit upright, and I was just completely gone with pain. I couldn't respond. I couldn't really talk because it was just very painful. Vomited a couple of times. I arranged for the ambulance to meet me halfway in case I stopped breathing. Got to the ambulance, got in the ambulance, IV, everything was ready. And the next thing that actually happened was the droopy eyelids. So I had severe ptosis, so I couldn't keep my eyes open. I started to have a very dry mouth. I had difficulty to swallow, excessive amounts of drooling as well. So I started to drool quite a bit. And by the time I reached the hospital, that's when the breathing difficulty started. Now,
wow.
What is the weirdest way, or what is really weird about it, is how it feels. It's almost like you have a truck parked on your chest. So every time you exhale, there's just more pressure as your muscles are becoming paralyzed.
Wow.
So that was pretty wild. And then I got, I think, 8 vials of antivenom. Spent 4 days in hospital and walked out. Went straight back to the snake, collected my data for my project I was working on at the time, and released it again, much to the disappointment of many people that wanted me to kill it.
No, it's crazy. And no other respiratory complications. Do you think that was because you met the ambulance halfway and got the IV in immediately?
Well, I think, look, the antivenom I got at hospital, but I just think that the time from the point of the bite to the point of antivenom was about 45 minutes.
Wow, that's good.
Within that time frame is when all of those symptoms started.
Wow.
But what was even stranger was on the side of my body where the snake bit me, I had a massive purple bruise. I'll see if I can find the picture and send it to you on Instagram.
Yeah, please.
So it's really interesting because, and this has never been documented before in mamba bites, where you get this excessive bruising. But you know, I'm quite lucky that I survived the mamba bite. But you know, at the same time, if you're in that situation and you're a person that is not used to any of this, I do not know how people will deal with that, whether they will have the mental capacity to be able to calm themselves down.
Yeah.
You know, and you read a lot of books, and you know, the thing is where people always say, yes, mamba bites, 1 hour to 7 hours is the usual time frame. But I never tell people, you know, you're not going to die within a matter of, you know, X amount of time, because sure, you also have to be realistic about it and know that every person reacts differently. Another very interesting mamba case I had, this one was wild, was a 5-year-old girl that was bitten 5 times, believe it or not, on a lower back. She got to hospital 7 hours after the bite. So we intubated her first. Then we pushed antivenom. I think we gave her about 20 vials, if I'm not mistaken. And she walked out of hospital 4 days later.
Wow.
Incredible. Incredible.
So, yeah.
Did you have any long-term effects from that?
Long-term, I won't say long-term effects, no. Maybe a bit of brain damage because I'm still messing with snakes, I suppose.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Has that changed how you approach your work with venomous snakes, particularly mambas? Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, you also have to be smart enough to be able to admit that you messed up. You know, you can't make excuses for it. At the end of the day, it's not the snake's fault. It was my fault.
Yeah. But
right now with mambas, and especially if I'm dealing with large individuals, I just try to calm myself down first, assess it, and then I'll do it. So my fiance also catches snakes, so she usually assists me if we're dealing with large black mambas, so that I don't have to tackle it alone.
Yeah. Smart.
So I think that's the approach I take now, rather tag team a large black mamba, and then just don't become complacent. And I mean, as difficult as this is, you know, it's very hard not to become complacent at the end of the day. You know, because we work with this stuff every single day of your life. So you kind of get used to a certain motion, et cetera, et cetera. So that's pretty tough.
Does it ever just pop into your head when you're doing something completely random that, shit, I got bitten by a mamba?
Not as much anymore, but in the past, yes. So yeah. What was really, really funny about the entire experience is I was in the ICU, so I wasn't ventilated, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah.
But I remember getting phone calls from newspapers and local TV stations and radio stations asking me if I know about the mamba bite. And it's like, yeah, you're speaking to him right now. I'm in the ICU.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
So, yeah. But it's interesting. But if I have to choose what I get bitten by, I will choose a mamba over a spitting cobra any day of the week.
Right.
Just in terms of what I know spitting cobras can do.
Yeah.
I'm going for Perengue every day of the week.
Yeah.
Perengues can be pretty bad. Make no mistake. They have a bit of neurotoxins. There's one girl that got bitten by one, and she ended up with a dilated pupil, I think. But she's about 30 years old now, and she still struggles with the same issues.
Wow.
Same goes for Zeropaga as well. They do tend to have a degree of neurotoxicity. Not as bad, but then again, you have to be very unlucky to get bitten by Zeropaga.
Yeah. You have to legitimately be a herper or a photographer and got way too close.
Ooh, are you guys into pythons or not really?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so we obviously have the OG python, which is the dwarf python, Angolan dwarf python.
Yeah.
So believe it or not, I have successfully found them on 5 occasions herping.
Really? Wow.
It's really strange. They like rock crevices for some reason. So if you're in the right habitat and you have rock crevices, you'll get them 9 times out of 10.
That's awesome.
They're very cool.
And is there specific phenotypes to your region, or are they all similar?
No, there's some differences, especially the further north you go, the more vibrant the patterns tend to become and the prettier they tend to look.
Right.
It's the same with Nigri Senta. The ones you find in the extreme northern parts of the country are freaking almost a cream white color if you look at the banding. And if you look at the ones from central Namibia, they're yellow. So it's an ugly snake. It doesn't look really good.
Yeah,
the same goes for Anchitas cobras. I mean, Naja Anchitae. That's a pretty impressive snake. The biggest one I caught was 2.4 meters.
You ever get the banded ones or no?
Yes. And the banded ones are absolutely fire. I mean,
really, bright purple.
So the brown is a purple brown color, and then you get these really vibrant yellow bands, especially from central Namibia where I'm based.
Very cool. They're
freaking stunning snakes.
Yeah, you got to send me pictures of that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think my species list for snakes that I still need for the country is between 30 and 40 out of the 85 we have.
What are you doing, man? Gotta bang that out.
Yeah, get out there. Get the book finished. What's the matter?
Yeah, let's do it. Get that book done.
It's just the dirt snakes that are avoiding me at the moment. That's the primary ones I still need to find.
So, that'll be a chapter that no one reads anyway. You think you're fine.
Yeah,
the freaking file summer. Snakes.
Oh, the file yeah, snakes that's are tough. Me. That's tough.
So we're gonna try for them now. We're actually getting ready for a big trip up to northeastern Namibia. So I'll be leaving on Friday. I'll be in the middle of nowhere again. So then we're gonna see if we can tick off some of those things. Amblyopia dipsis is also high on the list.
Excellent.
But not the purple gloss, not Polylepis, the Kalahari gloss snake.
Yeah, equally wow. Awesome.
To that note, you're going on a trip in the middle of nowhere. What are you packing? What's in your herp kit?
Well, the most important bit in my herp kit is my car keys, because that's the quickest I can get to help if something goes wrong. this area we're going to now has the highest rate of snake bite fatalities in the country, primarily black mamba, which is a bit frightening for me. But usually if I go out, I always make sure that I have radios, so keep comms between the teams that are going out and looking for stuff, flashlights, snake tongs, snake hook, stump ripper, hex armor gloves. Do I trust them? No, but better than having nothing. PIBs, pressure bandages, and then obviously first aid kit and lots of beer. Hot days can kind of kill you up there. So if we're not herping, we're going to have a beer.
So. Love it.
Sounds
I love
perfect.
It.
Sounds absolutely perfect. That's grand.
But, yeah. Guys, you need to make a plan. Come to Namibia. I'll show you. Gotta,
I won't lie, Nipper. We were talking about Pennsylvania, but may have to change things up a bit.
Yeah.
Well, and if I can tell you, the best time of the year to come would be round about Feb, because that's the onset of rainy season, and that's when you're going to find majority of the dwarf bitters. It's a really good time to come through. And just another bit of news, yeah, I've relocated to southern Namibia, so I'm managing a rewilding project now. So the property I'm managing is about 12,500 hectares.
Wow.
Prime herbing habitat. There's Codalis, there's black spitting cobras, Xeropaga, and some cordylids as well. So if you guys are keen, you're more than welcome to.
Yes. We didn't even get to talk about cordylids. Damn.
It sounds absolutely amazing. I mean, having, well, one species left, which fingers crossed I should see next month. I'm done for Europe. So looking for new challenges. Namibia.
I know your primary challenge now is finding all of the rattlesnakes in the States.
That's right. Which
was a pretty tough one. I was in the US in 2023. I was in Florida in your neck of the woods. I just got one snake and a knolls, which was quite disappointing.
Where were you?
I was in Miami itself, so okay. Pretty shit herping.
Yeah, it's rough. So, it's fucking rough, man.
So, but you know, again, what we did, or the reason I went to the US, is it was something funded by the US embassy because of all of the work I've been doing. So I got an international leadership program grant to be able to go to the States.
Very cool.
So nice. Traveling a bit, and shit, hopefully the Americans won't crucify me like as things are going now in the United States, but you actually funded one of my projects as well. One of my spitting cobra projects was funded by the kind American taxpayers. So
excellent.
That paper is going to be published soon as well.
Very cool. I don't have a problem paying taxes for.
Yeah, it wasn't a big grant, but hey, it got the job done. We learned more about spitting cobras. So there's exciting stuff coming out. We did some work on why they bite. So that's a note that was unfortunately rejected. So I'm looking for another journal. And then we have the translocation project, looking at how these snakes react to relocation. On that note, there is no effect. Spitting cobras are just the absolute worst. They adapt to everything.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Ideal. Anything else you'd like to put out there before we close up?
Oh, I think maybe I can mention what we found with the spitting cobras and why they bite.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not sure if that would be interesting, but yeah, so
1,000%.
We did a study in 2019. So I had a quarter gravid female zebra spitter. And we got all of the babies, so we set up a bit of a test to try and determine why these snakes are biting. And what we actually did was, this is very strange, but we took tampons, went to a local gym, taped it underneath the armpits of some gym junkies, and we took the sweat, and then donated a bit of blood, and then we had water as our control to try and determine what is going to draw a reaction out of the snake. So we placed the the tampon with sweat, blood, and water in the container for about 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, we would move it and push it down on the snakes to see if they would react. But what was interesting was majority of the snakes moved straight towards sweat. All of these hatchlings decided to smell it, and we had like three individuals that just latched onto it without moving it.
Wow.
Once we started to move it, they all just backed off. They decided either to spit or to retreat, but we had no biting whatsoever. So the hypothesis behind this is that these bites that we're seeing are not defensive bites. These bites are feeding responses. So I reckon what's happening is that the reason people are getting bitten by spitters is because that snake is in hunting mode. You're sweating at night when it's 40 degrees Celsius, whatever. That snake just smells it and is like, you know what? It's food.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
It's a hot mammal. I'm going to bite it.
Which is very, very scary stuff.
It is.
So, and they don't know, you know, they're not smart enough to determine whether something is too big or too small. Like if you take, for example, I had 70 centimeter Western Barred Spitting Cobras annihilating rock hyraxes, adult rock hyraxes, and trying to eat them. So wow. They're simply not that intelligent where they can determine something is too big or too small. So that's why I think they, you know, if it smells like food, it must be food.
Do they have they been observed eating carrion or pieces of carrion like Mozambicus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dead roadkill. They will gladly eat that. I mean, some of the ones I had in captivity back at the university, we used to feed them chicken gizzards, and they would just take them straight off the bat without no issues. So,
very interesting.
I've seen them eating dead snakes, dead lizards on the road, and dead rodents. So I just don't think they're picky at all. They even eat each other. So
yeah, I had a friend many years ago who had zebra spitters, and he was the only guy I knew that had them. He paid an exuberant amount of money for them, and he kept them for about a year, and he cooled them, and he got the timing right, and he put them together, and he walked away to go get another garbage bag or to go get a bottle of water or something, and he came back, and the male was halfway down the female's throat.
Oh, dear.
That is just in
5 minutes. That's enough time for him. Yeah. Him to walk to the kitchen. And I'm pretty sure this was late 2000s, maybe 2009, 2010. I think he paid like $5,000 each for them. Yeah.
Yeah. So to think we just get them by the bucket loads in the city. I have a bit of a question for you guys. So you keep spitters, I assume, Rinkholz. I believe.
Yes. Yeah.
What is your protocol in terms of working with those spitters? If you have to clean.
So spitters, I use latex gloves. I make sure I don't have any cuts or nicks or anything below the elbow. I usually wear t-shirts when I'm cleaning. So anything below the elbow, if there's any nicks or scrapes or whatever, I'll cover them up with a piece of packing tape or masking tape. I wear latex gloves. And then I have a full face shield that ratchets on the back. Almost looks like a welder's mask, but it's completely plexi. And it comes back far enough that it doesn't completely cover my ear. But unless I'm perpendicular to the snake, no venom would ever hit my ear. And then I'd go from there.
So, do you wear any respirators when you're cleaning the cages?
Nah. There was once a time when the theory on cleaning venom off glass was to let it dry and then use a razor blade and scrape it. And obviously, that's a horrible idea. We know now that's a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. And I've had some people that developed allergens because of that. I personally never did that because it just didn't make sense to me. But no, I've been very lucky in the stance that I am very, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm very cautious about that because I don't want to develop allergens.
Now, the primary reason I was asking you about that is because with spitting cobras and what we've been seeing over the course of the last few years is a lot of the guys that are handling snakes, and one of our protocols now is to always have a respirator on when you're working with them, is that literally it takes a year for some of these guys just to become highly allergic to them. I mean, it's so bad to the point where they can't even be in the same room as the snake.
Really?
Which is why I think, you know, it's such an important aspect of maintaining spitters. I mean, even the reptile park that I managed beforehand was the same story. So I drilled my team to always wear masks when they're cleaning cages, whether it's wiping the glass or whatever. Now, this reptile park phoned me the other day, or this lodge where this reptile park is, and one of their guys nearly went into full-blown anaphylaxis. And this was in an outdoor enclosure where he was just raking the enclosure, the dust from all of the snake poo. And this was a black mamba. And
wow,
he got exposed to spitting cobras because he used to catch them just with safety glasses. And over that prolonged period of time, his body started to react to it. So that's just why I'm asking out of interest's sake. And I think, you know, for keepers out there, if you're doing spitting cobras, any venomous snake, really, you have to remember those proteins that are in the venom might still be in the poo and stuff. And inhaling all of that is going to definitely put you in a bit of trouble along the lines. It's just one thing I'm always concerned about. And to make it even more scary is we can't test for this yet. So we cannot test if someone is allergic to snake venom or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been very lucky in that regard. I've kept a lot of spitting cobra species over the years. I've kept the majority of the African nausea species. I've kept personally, as well as worked in facilities that had them. And with the exception of a couple friends that used to do that glass scraping thing, I've been very, very good about not breathing that dust in of the urates and the feces and all that, and trying to, I've worn masks before if it's like really dusty mulch, but I've never had a symptom or a sign that I might be allergic. Now at this point, I'm kind of phasing them out with the exception of the wrinkles. I still have Ashii and Nubiae and some other non-spitting stuff, but the wrinkles is probably the only spitters I'm really going to focus on. And I really hope that I don't develop some kind of allergen, because I love those damn worms.
Yeah, it's an absolutely scary thing. That's just why I'm asking. And I know for your listeners out there and everyone that's thinking of potentially going towards the hot side of things is just having these protocols in place at all times. Make sure that you know what you're getting yourself into. And I feel like if you look at a lot of these YouTube channels that are out there at this stage, is they just show how to freehandle snakes. There's nothing about protocol on what you can do to prevent yourself from becoming allergic. They don't even show if they have EpiPens or what's in the kit. And young people
It's because they don't have a kit.
Well, that's also true. And then they waste the damn anti-venom that's in the States anyway, if they end up with a bite. But this is why it's always so important to have protocols. You know, even all of my snake catchers have their protocol for if shit hits the fan. I have my own protocol. Am I good with it? No, I'm also a bit terrible with it at times, but I always have an EpiPen with me. You know, I don't know if I'm allergic or not, so I might as well just keep the damn thing in case something goes wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you guys deal with a lot of this captive stuff. So in Namibia, interestingly enough, we're not allowed to keep any snakes. It's completely illegal.
Really?
Yeah. So that in itself is a big issue, because now we're sitting with, when was it? December. There was a confiscation on a boa constrictor, a freaking large one that someone was keeping. So now, because this thing is illegal, a whole bunch of people are doing it illegally. So you have no control over what's coming into the country. And the same goes for poaching. So again, we're trying to convince the government, at least just to give the people a small period of time so they can declare what they have, give them permits, and then manage it. And if we can get to a stage where we can actually just legally keep native species, a similar system to what you have in Australia.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, it's ridiculous. I mean, there was a Western Diamondback rattlesnake confiscated here a while back as well. So
wow.
So what is the damn point of having all of this, the, you know, having this legislation in place, but you cannot manage it? You know, I'd rather get a permit system and have control over the damn thing.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
So it's not easy. Africa can be difficult sometimes. But on the bright side, Namibia is better than South Africa. We're not dealing with half of the crap that they have. And we have electricity. Byron Bing, if you're listening, you know what it's about.
Good 100%. Enough, man.
Good enough. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes,
we really, really appreciate your time. Appreciate that it's a different time of the day for you than us. And for giving up your day for us is awesome. Thank you.
Not really. It's just like 2 hours in front of the UK. So it's more or less the same.
Oh, okay.
Excellent.
We still appreciate you coming on.
We do.
We will urge everybody to look out for your new book when it comes out. When it does come out, please give us a heads up so that we can publicize it. Because I'm sure a field guide with the venomous stuff of Namibia is going to sell like hotcakes.
I mean, his Instagram is pretty much a field guide of Namibia.
I mean, let's
he's already got all the workings, all the fixings.
We'll put your Insta, if you don't mind, we'll put your Insta up in the bio as well. Get you some followers.
Anytime. And if you guys also want to check out our YouTube channel, this is where we're trying to get some funding for the other snake catchers as well. It's simple, Snakes of Namibia. So you can watch some videos of us removing either mambas or spitting cobras from people's houses. Not as exciting, but we're
trying. I'll put the link in there as well.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. Phil, thank you for not dying during this podcast. I know you're not very well.
I've been muting myself and coughing off screen.
100%. So with that in mind, folks, thank you ever so much for listening. We appreciate you could be listening to anybody and you've decided to listen to us. Whatever time it is in the world where you are, have a splendid evening.
And thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.